please, if you have questions, come up and use the mic. Okay?
But before we entertain questions, Terry or anybody, do you want to say anything about this, the banner? About the banner?
We had a lecture on Google Mail.
Right, but what's the history of this banner? Because it's Trinity, it's our Trinity Parish banner.
Sally Blaine, who was a member of Trinity, made that years and years ago.
Okay.
Now, I've been there 24 years, so it must be, it was about 20 years ago.
So this is the Rublev icon just as a banner. So
diocesan events, they want us to bring like a coordination of a bishop or something. You want all the parishes to bring.
Right. So I wrestled it into my car. It's a little worse for wear, and I'll be taking it back. But it's really quite something. Okay, the floor is yours. Is there a question, comment, argument? If you could come to the mic, that would be great.
One thing that came to mind while you were talking was a couple years ago, Patricia Friesen did a 2-day seminar with us on the Beatitudes from the Aramaic.
Uh-huh.
And she said that the word that we translate as blessed or happy is actually tends to mean something more like ripe.
Huh.
Is, and so that seemed like what you were saying about as we were, you know, becoming more
ready to
mature and more ready.
Yeah, that's interesting. So. Yeah, the problem, Makarios is the Greek word, and I think it means happy. I think in both blessed and happy, but it's always interesting to find out what Aramaic words might mean. And again, in terms of Jesus, you know, we didn't talk about environmental issues, but there's a really interesting group of people now that are doing what they call post-colonial biblical scholarship. And when I was at Seabury, we hired a guy for an entry-level New Testament position who is Indian, a man named Raj Nadella, who's gone on to be a very productive scholar. But he was a post-colonial New Testament scholar, and he would just get up in chapel and preach these sermons about, like, these parables, and he'd sort of make you look at them from a kind of subject people's point of view or an agricultural point of view. So Jesus did talk in agricultural terms. And sometimes it requires an act of imagination for us to really, because you know we're all pretty much removed from natural processes in our daily lives. But Jesus is talking to people who really lived with the natural world very closely, and so it's important to try to do that. Raj Nadella, R-A-J, Nadella, N-A-D-E-L-L-A. Really lovely guy. He was a Roman Catholic lay person who taught some. Come on up if you're going to use. Come to the mic. Come on down. That's right.
It's more of a comment.
Sure.
There was a sentence that struck me.
Okay.
When Rohr says, it's something you can experience. It's something you can experience only by resting inside of the relationship.
Uh-huh.
And that hit me for two things, reasons. One, it's not just a Jungian statement. I think he is referring to contemplation. And
to contemplation.
Contemplation. I've been taking for 20-some years a class at adult ed. Teacher is not religious, but he is a meditator. And he does, every so often, a very deep guided meditation where we literally lie down. And afterwards, we write down the images that came to us. And in one of those meditations, the image that came to me, I'm climbing up a hill, and I come at the top of the mountain to an A-frame structure. and I feel compelled to go up a stairway until I'm somewhere in the middle towards the high point of the A-frame structure. And I look out, and I have a view over unlimited space. It's a huge, all-encompassing view. It was stunning. And I heard the words, take a leap. And then I come down the stairway, and I'm finding myself in a giant room with a window, but no glass, and there's only one chair smack in the middle of the room facing out. And I'm asked to sit down and meditate. And I forgot what came to me. But the point is, I didn't understand what the whole thing meant.
Right.
So I asked my teacher afterwards, what the heck is the A-frame cabin doing up there? And he said, it's an innate symbol that surfaces in from the unconscious in all people from all culture. In the Western world, for instance, he said, the Trinity is one of those symbols. And the fact, reading this, he said, stay with it, the answer will come to me, to you. Every image has a meaning that will speak to you in your life. And it came to me when I was reading this book.
What page is that on?
When he said, resting inside of the relationship.
What page?
It's 91. Okay. It's something you can experience only by resting inside of the relationship. Mm-hmm. And I thought, when I climbed up the stairway and I looked out, the insight that came was, look at the larger picture. And then the solution, when I came down and I saw the chair in the empty room, meditate in order to see the larger picture. And I think by being smack in the triangle of the A-frame, I was inside of the relationship. And from that was born the insight. The larger picture will only come to you through the relationship that you experience in meditation when you self-empty. Anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, and just pointing again to the icon, there's the empty space for you at the table, right? So, and Rohr has this theory that there was a mirror there, right, and that fell off. No, that's serious. And that's it's earlier in this book. He talks about this. One of the theories is that there's the actual icon, if you go see the actual icon, there is like something was stuck on that's missing. And he is one of the people who thinks it was a mirror, so that when you contemplated the icon, you saw yourself at the empty space in the table. And so you're right in terms of this idea of... And again, the problem is, again, and I, you know, one of the problems with us Westerners, and I say this as a Westerner, is that we tend to think that the meaning of something is, that the importance of something is what it means cognitively, you know, that it's all in your, I think it's the Protestant thing that even if you're a Catholic, you're still in a Protestant culture, and the Protestantism is all about intellectual understanding of something. I mean, our churches look like lecture halls. One of the things we did when I was dean of the Cathedral in Washington is, it was a colleague of mine thought this up, we took the chairs out for 1 week a year. And if you actually go and look at the Washington Post sometimes, we called it Seeing Deeper, and they had some pictures. And we do all kinds of interesting things for a week in that building with the chairs taken out. But it was interesting to watch people. It was kind of like when you go to the beach, you know, and how people sort themselves out. Some people go into the water. Some people sit down and read a book. Some people throw a frisbee. You know, some people build a sandcastle. So people respond to the beach sort of like, authentically. And taking the chairs out of a church, you saw people responding to sacred space authentically. You know, and we've turned churches into lecture halls. And so we think that, again, the most important thing is what's being said intellectually about the Bible reading. But I think that sort of just being in the space and being open to God's presence as revealed in that space is actually more important. So I think also in terms of what you're saying about, you know, resting in a relationship, we've got to get over our Western prurience for intellectual content, you know. And one of the things I love about being here, I'm a longtime associate of the Order of the Holy Cross, the order Mount Calvary is part of, and I love being able to go up there for the offices when I can. And there's something about this contemplative prayer and opening yourself up and not just thinking hard all the time that is really liberating. And I think is right about, as again, as Rohr says on page 90, and thank you so much for that, or 91, that it's something you only up, it's something you can only experience by resting inside of the relationship's prayer, as when the disciples asked Jesus where he lived, and he offered this intimate advice, come and see. Yeah, so. Yes, come on up.
I've had benefit of reading some of Cynthia, Reverend Cynthia's work previously, and so have encountered a little bit of Gergiev. In the,
good.
In the, right. And Cindy and I, my wife, Reverend Cindy, and my wife and I actually attended the Trinity conference that Reverend Cynthia and Reverend Richard and William Paul Young did in Albuquerque a couple
of
weeks ago. And one of the things about the this resolution of the law of three and synthesis, antithesis, and or the thesis, antithesis, and the idea of synthesis is my sense, going back to the issue of the abortion issue you're talking about, the fourth place where the miracle happens is in each of us.
Right.
Right. So we come to our own miraculous thought, and I think many of us aren't there yet in terms
right.
of how we resolve it. But in fact, my sense is that we're called as part of this divine dance to actually listen and be part of and feel all of this, and that we will come, if in fact we sit with it, we will actually come with our own holy solution to this, because we have God in us to listen to all these outside forces. And so to me, and that goes back to the point you're making earlier about my obligation to sit with it and not take a synthesis or an you know, but to really sort of sit with it and then come with my own holy response.
That's really helpful. You know, what immediately comes to mind, and forgive me if I'm too political, but I am. I did just move here from Washington, but the current political situation in which our nation finds itself. You know, I'll just speak for myself. I'll make an I statement. So I'm on the opposite side of a lot of things from a lot of supporters of the current president. And my question is, how do I live with that antithesis, right? I mean, how do I live with that opposition? I'm not very comfortable being in this position. I don't like, but yet I've got strong positions. And I led a retreat on this actually last spring, and it was called Surviving Spiritually in the Time of Trump. And what the group actually came to, it wasn't just me, but what the group really came to was that we do have an obligation. These are all people, obviously, who were not thrilled with the current president. But they felt, A, that they were in churches where there were people who loved the current president, and how did they reconcile with them? And then there were also all these other people who we feel are at risk from the policies of the current administration. And I think what we decided was that we need to find a way to reach out to the people on the other side of the divide. But we need first to make common cause with the people who are at risk, was what we felt. In other words, and I don't know if this is the same kind of thing, but in other words, it's that, I mean, I need to find a way not to characterize or stigmatize people who love Donald Trump, even though I'm not one of those people. And, but I need to do that. But my first obligation as a follower of Jesus is, if I see people who are at risk, poor people, women, LGBT people, people of color, that my first obligation as a follower of Jesus is to be in solidarity with them. And then not to foreclose the opportunity of reconciling with the people on the other side, but that in some ways I've got to deal with it in stages or something. So I've got to sort of hold on to my moral... So it's this question of, like, how do I find common ground with people where I'm on the opposite side of them, you know? And again, I think you're right that it is something that has to happen internally. I'm hoping it can happen socially in some way, but that feels like a way off right now.
Well, my sense is that it's actually new ground, not common ground.
Right. I think that's right. It's new ground, not common ground, and that's what Gurdjieff and Cynthia Bourgeau would say, and Rohr would say, is it's not that you're trying to find a synthesis or a lowest common denominator.
Right.
It's kind of like the interfaith thing in the same way, right? In other words, I'm a Christian. I've studied Buddhism, especially with Zen Buddhism. So how do I stand in my own tradition as a follower of Jesus, but also find common ground with, or find a way to be with people in other traditions? We did a lot of interfaith work at the National Cathedral, and what I found is interesting over the course of my working life, you know, when I was first ordained and we did interfaith things, they were all kind of weirdly unsatisfying, lowest common denominator interfaith services that just made your skin crawl. They were talking about God in this very abstract, fuzzy way and that stuff. Well, now what we do is, you know, when we do a thing in my place, we do a kind of an inclusive, inviting kind of Christian liturgy. When I would go to the Muslim center out by Dulles Airport, we would do an Islamic service. I mean, that we stand in our tradition and we try to find a way to do that invitingly rather than exclusively, and that ultimately, though, that will lead to a new thing rather than some kind of melding of the thing. And I think that helps me understand also the thing you were talking about, of what's the fourth... Right, right. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. I always get nervous.
They call me sir. They got to call
okay,
you ma'am.
Okay. No, it's when the young people say, yes, ma'am.
That's right.
Anyway, thank you for being here. You make me want to be a Protestant again. Anyway, thank you very much. Very enlightening. I want to, maybe everybody else got this, but for me it was an aha moment. Merton is, now I may not say this correctly, so everybody just calm down.
I'm ready to give you an absolute.
Okay, no. Merton went over. Merton was my guy when Seven Story Mountain just was great. Anyway, when he went over there, it was about different kinds of meditation to see where the commonality was.
Right.
And what I got today when he said about the inner connection between religions, that's where the meditation is. We have these interdenominational services, and we all kind of, well, that's a good thing, you know. But it's the inner that's all the same.
Right.
In meditation, it's all different, but it's all the same. And I think that's my personal belief, is we're kind of getting towards a tipping point on that, hopefully. That whatever political persuasion we're in, that we can come together inner, you know, on the inside.
Right. I think that's right. I mean, I felt you said it. That's why I think it's so...
Merton said it.
That's why I think it's so smart, because I said it. I've long felt that people would come together at the level of prayer practice. You know, that... And I think... I'm just looking for the place where...
It was in that group, two paragraphs, I think.
Well, he talks about Merton and about how I can't find it now. But when
but
he's talking about
it.
Thomas Merton in the chapter we read, he talks about the fact that people who are deeply contemplative are able to talk to each other immediately. You know,
because they leave the other out here.
Right, right. We had one of the when I was in D.C. We had I got to spend a day with the Dalai Lama, And Kathy said, I kind of came home like walking, like levitating across the house, you know. He's someone who lives this deeply contemplative life. And it's just you know, palpable in his presence, that the depth of that life, right? And he has this instant empathy with everybody because of the depth of that contemplative existence. And I think that, like, when Merton was in Bangkok, and the Buddhists and the Catholics and the, you know, we're all able to just talk to each other without any of the filtering that has to happen when clergy get together, you know, was really something. But it was because of that inner life,
yes,
that they shared, which is the same when you get beyond
the culture, the ego.
The culture and all stuff, it's the same thing.
And that we're right.
Right. Right.
Right.
Right.
Thank you.
Sure thing. Thank you. I mean, I want to say, too, talking about Merton. So I spent the Advent last year at residence in the Episcopal Cathedral in Cincinnati, helping them work on what it means to be a cathedral. And so I had a couple of free days, so I went down to Gethsemane, which is Thomas Merton's monastery, which is not that far from Cincinnati. It's in Kentucky. And I loaded up with souvenirs. You know, it's like I had this duffel bag of fruitcakes and mugs and all that stuff. And I gave a mug to my best friend and his wife. I gave them a mug. I should have given them each a mug, but I gave them one mug. And my friend Larry says, the problem is it's great, but they now fight with each other. Who's going to get down to breakfast first so they can get the Gethsemane mug? You know, and I said, you're not really getting the experience if you're fighting over the Thomas Merton mug, right?
I just I've always loved the title of Matthew Fox's book, One River, Many Wells, and that's what she was doing.
One River, Many Wells, right? Yes, ma'am.
So thank you for bringing up lots of things today.
Sure.
One of the things that came to me, and you may be too young to address this, I don't know, but you talked about how the job is building up the ego, the first part of our lives, and then tending to the soul.
Right.
And then comes letting it all go, which is really the task that I'm noticing in friends and, you know, here we are. And just what do you say that could be helpful in this context?
Wow. I do think, again, I'm 68, not 86, so I do think obviously the task of life is, you know, when I did this book at the men's retreat at Trinity in the spring, I like to work with visual art and poetry a lot when I do, because I used to be an English teacher, but I also like to work with visual art increasingly as I get older. And I did it with in concert with this four-painting sequence by Thomas Cole, the great American painter, called The Voyage of Life. I don't know if any of you have seen. It's in the National Gallery in Washington. Thomas Cole painted in the early, mid-19th century. He was the first great Hudson River School painter. And he has an allegorical painting sequence called The Voyage of Life. And it's four paintings: childhood, youth, adulthood, and old age. And the first painting is, and it's all, the first painting is this infant coming out of this cave down a stream of life in this boat. And everything's bright, beautiful, new, young, and everything. The second is the youth going down the same stream, like pointing to this castle in the air he's about to build with all these dreams, you know. The third, which is when I first encountered this series of paintings, is adulthood, and it's this guy, now a man, sort of going like this on the boat, and it's about to shoot the rapids, right? Which we can all identify with. And the fourth painting is the man, now quite old, going down, going towards the open sea and looking up towards heaven, you know, and about to be reunited with the source. So I do think that is it's, you know, Augustine, to bring back Augustine, and I think he talks about Augustine more in this, but Augustine says our souls are restless until they rest in you. And as I get older, I find myself being drawn more towards God than I did when I was younger in a way. And so I do think it's not only a question of giving it all up, but it's a question of returning to my source in some way. And so my mother just died in November, and so I spent a good part of the last several years being with my, even though she was out here in the motion picture home and I was back east, I came out here a lot to be with her. And, you know, I just saw her, she was 91, and as she came close to dying, closer and closer to dying, this sense of not only resignation and of, like, you know, really being content with much less than she had wanted earlier in life, but also the sense of somehow reconnecting to the source of her being. So I do think that is the kind of the next stage of the journey. But somehow being able to shed not only my stuff, and I always say I'm on the downward slope now. If stuff breaks, I don't replace it, you know. I mean, I don't really need, I don't need the stuff I needed, I guess, is what I'm saying. But also that sense of shedding the false parts of myself so that I'm equipped to, you know, I don't think God wants me to bring my diplomas with me, you know, when I return to my source. So, I mean, again, I am a little too young, but I'm in the process of, I feel like I'm beginning that, this stage now of that process. And so, I do think that is the journey. And the problem is we live in a culture that fights against all that as much as it can, right? And so, the culture does not support us in that process. You know, it's like the culture does not support marriage, I don't think. I mean, we have a lot of falsely sentimental stuff we say about marriage. But marriage is really saying, you know, when you get married to somebody, whether it's of the same or the opposite gender, you're saying, I'm going to find my fulfillment in mutuality rather than in independence. And that's a really countercultural thing to say, right? And I think one of the things the church needs to do is figure out how we support people in that mutual fulfillment rather than in that individual fulfillment. Well, in the same way, in terms of the kind of journey you're talking about, you know, our culture just says, hang on to the last minute and get everything you can, you know, while you're still alive. And so we've got to find a way to really make it okay for people to live more simply and to let stuff go, because I think that is probably the task of this time of life. Come on up.
Thank you. You've really ignited a lot of things in me. But one of the things that I think is another layer that hasn't been mentioned and that I really don't hear much about that just occurred to me sitting here is relationship. We want to have a relationship with God. I mean, understand as self, we want to go to our authentic self, our true self. But I also think most of us don't know how to be in relationship. We don't know what relationship, authentic, let's say authentic relationship. You brought up the example of marriage. Right. But we don't know how to be in a relationship without an agenda at any time, really, you know. So to be in an agendaless relationship, which I think spirituality in its purest form maybe asks us to be or invites us or welcomes us to be in this agendaless relationship with God. And that can ripple out to each other.
Right.
But again, it's sort of a Western or an ego or idea that I have to shed myself or solidify myself or protect my, I mean, all of those things that would move us into even the human-to-human authentic relationship.
Right.
I know this is very kind of, I'm a communication person, that's my background, but I think it's the complexity too is hard enough to learn to be who you are or to shed who you're not so you can welcome who you truly are.
Right.
But then to take that into an availability that welcomes the other and welcomes the divine presence, which is welcoming a part of who we are,
right,
which is the most intimate part of who we are,
right,
the most pure form, or I would hope, I would believe, is the more pure part of us. So I just, from a relational perspective, I just wonder your thoughts about that, because we're invited into a relationship with God. And I don't know,
sure,
that we know how to be in relationship. There's not a... so what
sure. That, no, that's very helpful. And because you're right. I talked about the self stuff because it was a way to...
Oh, no.
No, I was talking about the self... No, I'm not trying to be defensive. I'm just saying I think the self stuff was because he was talking about the Logos being the formation, that we are, you know, formed by the Logos and part of the Logos. And so I wanted to get at that self stuff as a way to understanding the authenticity of God, in a way. A couple of thoughts. I'm glad my wife is not here for me to, presuming to talk about relationships. A couple of thoughts. One of them is that when I used to do a class, when you're dean of a seminary, you inherit a couple of classes that go with your job, and one of them was about the life of prayer. And one of the things I've always felt about, again, this is going to come back to the self in a way, but prayer is a relationship. And so if I'm in relationship, if I'm going to pray, I need to try to come into that relationship as I am and not as a cartoon of what I think a pious person ought to be, right? And so I think one of the hardest things when people start praying is that we want to, you know, we want to be like these, you know, St. Francis or somebody, you know. And again, part of the job is sort of presenting myself to God where I really am and not as I think a saintly person ought to be. That's one of the reasons I think that using the Psalms, even the really ugly Psalms, is an important part of the life of prayer, because there's some really ugly attitudes expressed in some of those Psalms. And they're kind of like attitudes I actually have. So Psalm 109, if you're really looking for a psalm to really get you started about somebody, that'll do it for you. But I think that's right. So I do think that relationship, that prayer is a relationship, and that prayer is just not me bringing my list, my agenda to God, right? God, please fix the following things. World peace, national disruption, and the following friends of mine who are sick, right? I mean, that's where we all kind of start with these petitions in prayer. But the more you get into the dialogical part of prayer, you realize that prayer is as much listening as it is speaking, right? So the spiritual task is prayer to me is about God's getting my attention. You know, I already have God's attention. But the issue for me in the life of prayer is God's getting my attention. And so one of the reasons for all these prayer practices, be they meditation or prayer at set times of day or something, is to open myself to what God is doing. So it is a relationship. I'd say the other thing about the relationship issue goes back to the Martin Buber stuff I was saying. I guess this is the last thing I'll say. But, you know, so Buber's idea of I and thou, that my relationship with, that I am a subject, and that my relationship with God needs to be a relationship of a subject with a subject. You know, God is not just other, God is someone. And I think a lot of times, and again, this may be a Western predisposition, we tend to treat others as objects. Right? We live in a consumer society. We tend to objectify the other. And I think the real hardest thing in relationship is, I mean, I love your term, agendaless relationship. But it's also identifying with the subjectivity of the other. That my wife is not just an object in my consciousness. My wife is actually an other with an inner subjectivity that I need to be open to. And I think, you know, in some ways we're all, I was thinking about all these, you know, stuff they talk about. One of the problems with, like, psychopaths is that they don't, in all sense, we live in a kind of psychopathic culture, right? I mean, that we tend to objectify everybody that's not me. And I used to teach preaching, and one of the hardest things to teach in preaching, or in writing, I used to teach composition too. One of the hardest things with young preachers is, young preachers think that their job is to get up and say something ingenious about the gospel this week. You know, I'm going to say something that no one's ever said before, and you're going to just be so impressed with the ingenuity of what I have to say that you're going to say, "Oh my God, isn't he smart and articulate?" You know, that is a very low level of preaching, of, you know, ingenious amazement. I think what you're trying to do when you're preaching is to sort of say something that you think the other person needs to hear about what the gospel is saying. You know, what is the gospel saying? So you have to sort of get inside the head and heart of the person you're speaking to. And again, it has to become a relational conversation rather than just an ingenious, an impressive declamation, right? And so I do think it has something to do that prayer is the great relationship, and that human relationships need to start at that I-thou place. And we need to find a way to get to that I-thou place, but that takes an enormous amount of work and openness and willingness to be, I mean, to be agendaless, but also to be brought into a fourth space by that other person. Because it's like one of the things in Lectio Divina that I love, in that sort of way of reading the Bible where you first, the monastic way of reading the Bible where you listen first to the word or phrase that gets your attention, and then what's it saying to me, and then the final thing is how am I calling to change in response to this word. And I think the other thing about relationship is, how am I open to change? If I'm really open to the subjectivity of the other, it means that my encounter with the other, I'm really open to being changed by the other. And, you know, anyone that lives with me very long will tell you, my first reaction is almost always defensive. And to give you 9 reasons why what you just accused me of is really bogus. But it seems to me the older I get, the more I'm willing to entertain the possibility of seeing it from the other person's point of view. And I'm an infant in this regard. But so don't do as I do. Don't do as I do. Do as I say. Don't imitate me. Imitate Jesus in this. But there's something about that willingness to empathize with the other person and their subjectivity, and the willingness to be changed by what they bring to the encounter, that really is central not only to the life of prayer, but to human relationships. And with that, as Martha is standing, I'm going to shut up. And thank you so much for the opportunity to be here with you. You're welcome.
This has been a rich feast, hasn't it? So my word to you is, go forth and digest.